Veritas Academy was chosen by Niche as the number one Christian and private school in Northern Virginia and third in the state of Virginia. Have coffee with the headmaster every Tuesday morning. Schedule your visit now. VeritasAcademyDC.com. VeritasAcademyDC.com.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, O'Connor and Company.
WMAL 607 on WMAL. This is O'Connor and Company getting you started this Thursday morning in the nation's capital. Amber, you know how I have, you reach a certain age and you just start forgetting things. It just occurred to me, I just remembered, I think I left my laptop at a shop in Delaware many years ago.
Well, I'm going to go pick it up and give it to the New York Post if that's all right.
Yeah, it should be fine. There's nothing on it really that I'm... You know what? No, I got it. I'll take care of it. It's probably best if I take care of this.
All right, fair enough.
Come to think of it. Some family photos. I don't want out. Hey, coming up this morning, we got a bunch to talk about at 6:35. Brian Darling is going to join us, talk about what's going to happen in the Senate with regard to the filibuster. It's like Joe Biden was in the Senate for like 40 years and he still doesn't quite understand what's the purpose of that place. It should operate more like the House of Representatives. It's like, well, no, that's the whole point. We have a House of Representatives. 7:05, Terry Schilling will join us. Fairfax Dad, talk about those viral images of children in Fairfax eating outdoors in 30-degree weather. 7:35, Chef Jeff Tracy will talk about enforcing Mayor Bowser's vaccine mandate at the restaurant level. And then at 8:35, incoming Attorney General for Virginia, Jason Meares. That's all coming up here. Yesterday, Jen Psaki took to the podium, and she responded to certain criticisms of Joe Biden's speech.
Senator Romney today basically said, I'll use the exact quote, that the speech yesterday that the president gave was, quote, going down the same tragic road taken by President Trump and casting the doubt on the reliability of American elections. Does the White House have a response to that?
With all due respect to Senator Romney, I think anyone would note there's a night and day difference between fomenting an insurrection based on lies totally debunked by 80 judges, including Trump-appointed ones, and election authorities across the country, and making objective, true statements, which is what the president made yesterday about the effects of a coordinated nationwide effort to undermine the constitutional right to vote. I know there has been a lot of claim of the offensive nature of the speech yesterday, which is hilarious on many levels, given how many people sat silently over the last 4 years for the former president. But I would note that in our view and the president's view, what is far more offensive is the effort to suppress people's basic right to exercise who they want to support and who they want to elect. That's not a partisan thing. And that was why he gave such a strong speech yesterday.
All right, let's take the second part first. You know, it's really, really amazing that all these people who just sat idly by and didn't say anything during the former president's offensive remarks would now criticize Joe Biden and say he was wrong. It was Mitt Romney, Amber. I mean, last I checked, Mitt Romney once in a while would speak out against Donald Trump.
He didn't like Donald Trump very much, actually. And I'm pretty sure when he started his Senate campaign, he explicitly called out Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no fan of Senator Romney, frankly, in terms of his insistence on finding any opportunity to divide himself with the president and to demean the supporters of the former president. But on this, he does have a bit of a moral standing where he can say, no, I'm pretty sure I criticized Trump and now I'm criticizing your guy. By the way, isn't this also a tacit admission from Jen Psaki? When you say that speech from Biden was offensive and her only response is, yeah, but Trump... I mean, that sort of acknowledges, yes, it was offensive, just not as bad as Trump.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Larry. I think that she is acknowledging that it was divisive and almost giving validity to the criticisms that people have made of Biden's speech.
By the way, let's remind you some of the things that Joe Biden said. I take this that Tulsi Gabbard, by the way, another Democrat, has also been incredibly critical of President Biden's speech. Tulsi Gabbard tweeted this part of the speech out and said this: Hillary's calling tens of millions of Americans deplorables was divisive and disgusting. But Biden has gone further, calling those who disagree with his actions and policies domestic enemies, traitors, and racists. Biden promised to unite us, but he's doing all he can to divide us. Here's what he said.
I will defend the right
for democracy.
Our democracy against all enemies, foreign and yes, domestic. A consequential moments in history. They present a choice. Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace? Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis? This is the moment to decide, to defend our elections.
You're either on my side or on the side of the racists. Yeah. So these are the lines that are being drawn here as we enter this debate. And the debate will really sort of be in earnest today as the House of Representatives takes up this measure on so-called voting rights, which really just federalizes voting protocols that have always been in the purview of the states. It will basically be tantamount to doing away with photo ID in whatever state that currently has a photo ID protocol. It will also, this gets overlooked because everyone talks about the photo ID aspect as well they should, but it will also institutionalize and legalize ballot harvesting that we've seen in California, where political action committees and organizations can go door to door, building to building, nursing home to nursing home, and collect people's ballots on their behalf and say, oh, yeah, we'll deliver them for you. Yeah, what could go wrong there, Amber?
Yeah, definitely no fraud involved there. Going back to Psaki's comments for a moment, I don't think that her claim about Trump deserves to be taken seriously, but I'm going to do it for a second anyway.
Okay.
Because even if you were to compare Biden's speech with anything that Trump tweeted about his political enemies, I think there's something to be said for the fact that Trump was always attacking other politicians and other people in positions of power. Biden attacks the American people. He doesn't seem to like them very much. His administration is going after Georgia and Texas and various other states for enacting laws they don't like. He has accused the unvaccinated of prolonging the pandemic and warned them of a winter of severe illness and death. He has classified parents as domestic terrorists. I think if we're going to do whataboutism, then Biden's is actually much worse than anything Trump did.
It's a very important and valid point, and you're absolutely right. This is every attack that Joe Biden is making right now, and by extension Chuck Schumer and every other Democrat you see speaking out about this over the course of the next several days, they are attacking the voters who support these IDs. They're saying you are Bull Connor. They're saying you are Jefferson Davis. They're saying you are the problem. And one other thing, I think that the larger point is incredibly valid. She claims that, Donald Trump said that the election was illegitimate. Donald Trump led an insurrection. I'm sorry, when you use rhetoric like this, when you say that black people's votes are being discounted, that people are not having the ability to vote, that people's votes are being suppressed, if you're saying that we don't have free and fair elections lest we pass this law, then you're basically inspiring people to distrust the government that wins the next election. And you're inspiring them to behave the way that they did when Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016, which is to call him illegitimate, take to the streets, burn things down, and resist every step of the way. This is exactly the behavior. There's no difference in my mind, just as Mitt Romney said.
And there's nothing surprising about this, because if you go all the way back to Biden's initial speech when he announced that he was running for president, what did he do? He lied. He said that Donald Trump had never denounced neo-Nazis, white nationalists, white supremacists. And that was a divisive speech on the lines of race. And he has continued to do that throughout his entire presidency.
Yeah. Well, sorry, Jen Psaki. You're on the wrong side of this one. And as usual, on the wrong side of history. Coming up, we're going to talk to Brian Darling about the legislative process and how this is actually going to come down in today's House vote. And then as it moves to the Senate. And pay attention, by the way, to some local Democrats. You know that Congresswoman Spanberger down at the 7th Congressional. She likes to separate herself from Pelosi. She likes to put out a lot of press releases and pretend like she's the moderate in the room, that she's not. Like, she co-sponsored this. She specifically, Virginia 7, are you paying attention? Because moderate, middle-of-the-road Spanberger, she's championing this federal takeover of elections. Moms that are making curious decisions about their children in the wake of COVID. And this one's in Frederick, Maryland, your hometown. This is a Frederick, Maryland mom and director of a thing called We Need Diverse Books. And she's shared on social media. Boy, where would they be without social media, these moms? Their daughter's begging to not go back to school. So she's keeping her kids remote.
begging to go back to school.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Excuse me. It's the COVID clotting my brain. Yeah, the kids are dying to go back to school, but she refuses to allow their children any happiness in her life.
Yeah, she interviewed with NPR about this, and she talks about how she, even though her children's schools are open, she pulled her kids out, and she thought everything was fine, and she does this NPR interview. Well, her daughter overheard the interview, and her daughter left her this note that says, "I want to go to school. Can I go? 3 question marks. Please," with like 20 E's in there. So it's more like,
it's spelled P-L-E-E-E-E-E-E-E-E. So this is while she's on the air with NPR saying, yes, I'm not going to let my children go back to school because it's just too dangerous. And we can...
And they're doing just fine. They love it.
Yeah. And she, meanwhile, they're like acting like they're, you know, hostages. Can I go P-E-E-E-E-E-E? And by the way, it's spelled with nothing but E's. There's no A in there. So something tells me maybe the kids do need to go back to school. Because this child, I don't know how old she is, God bless her, but she can't spell please. But again, she shares all this on Twitter as if there's some sort of badge of honor. Why does everything get shared on social media? If I were the mom, I'd be a little mortified, actually, in this. But clearly she's proud.
Yeah, she's continuing to keep her kids out of school despite this desperate plea. It's really quite sad. We talked about this yesterday about moms basically abusing their children in the name of COVID. There's another mom in this article from Nashville, Tennessee, and she says that she voluntarily kept her daughter, who's 15, home from her freshman year of high school, even though schools, again, were in person. But her daughter got depressed, developed anxiety, and lost 15 pounds. Because of her mother's decision.
There's some sort of, I think that these moms, and so I've been married to a mom, and I can see what social media does to moms that get into these circles of self-affirmation and reinforcement of other moms, where they all got each other's backs. We moms have to get each other's backs, and they get into these support groups, and any little thing that happens in their life, they have to run to Facebook, and they say, oh my God, this just happened, and here's a picture of it, and here's a picture of me looking at the picture of it, and here's a picture of me taking a picture of me looking at a picture of the thing that I just took a picture of. And they pour their hearts out there, and they've got all these, oh, you did the right thing, mom. You're doing the right thing. Don't worry, mom. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to, you know, talk down to moms right now, but I think sadly there are a lot of moms that don't have great support from the dads in those families and don't have a firm hand from the dads in those families as well. And I think that they get incredible social benefit from laying it all out there and getting all of this affirmation and all of this support. And moms that do these things, it's like, you know, the school district said that the kids should go back to school, but I'm keeping my kids out, and here's why. And it's like, oh, you're so brave and you're so right. Thank God they have you as their mom. And this is their world, Amber.
Yeah.
And they're thinking about their own personal, egotistical, narcissistic benefit that they get out of this and losing sight of the children right there in the room with them who are pleading for them or losing 15 pounds and wasting away in front of them. But it's more important for them to make sure that they get the social media cred they're looking for.
I've seen this trend as well, where if you criticize moms in any way, even if your criticisms are valid, you're accused of mommy shaming.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think there's some validity to that. I do think that there's a lot of cases where people, you know, provide these unsolicited opinions about parenthood that really they have no business giving. But in this case, if your kids are depressed and begging to go back to school and you're claiming that their risk of COVID is greater than of developing COVID is greater than the risk of these mental health issues, even when the evidence is right there in front of you, yeah, you should be shamed. And we're going to shame you because you are abusing your children, throwing your kid in the trunk, not taking your son to get his ankle x-rayed because you're scared that the hospitals aren't treating COVID properly.
Right.
I mean, this is, it's just horrific to see this happening and how brainwashed some of these people really are.
And you get one guess as to how they vote. And I think you got it right. So you saw this video. This is Fairfax County school children sitting outside in the curb. They're all bundled up. They're sitting on the cold pavement, by the way, too, on concrete. This is outside Wayne Woods School. And I guess they were getting instruction or something.
Apparently it was like story time.
Yeah.
I think that teacher was reading to them from a book.
And they're all outside, freezing their butts off, literally, because they're sitting on the concrete, wearing their coats, and socially distanced. What is going on in Fairfax? We're going to hear from Terry Schilling about that later on. Next, though, let's find out exactly what's going to happen with this voting takeover of the federal government and whether the filibuster will hold. That's next with Brian Darling.
Now, from the WMAL WynnBET Studios, O'Connor and Company.
WMAL 6:37 right now on O'Connor and Company. Thanks for tuning in to WMAL. Coming up at 7:05, we're going to check in with Terry Schilling and get what's really behind that viral video of children sitting outside in freezing temperatures for Fairfax County. Can Fairfax County School District do better? Can't they? 7:35, Chef Jeff Tracy is going to join us to talk about how it is for restaurants to enforce Mayor Bowser's vaccine passport law. Regulation. It's not a law. And at 8:35, Jason Miares, incoming Attorney General for the Virginia Commonwealth, is going to join us. Amber Athey, good morning to you. Thanks for dragging my COVID butt along here today.
Good morning. We're just glad you're back, Larry.
Thank you. Brian Darling is the president of Liberty Government Affairs, former counsel and senior communications director for Senator Rand Paul. And Brian, you know how the Senate operates. So what's going to happen here? The House is going to vote on this so-called voting rights bill, and that makes its way to the Senate. And then how does this all go down with regard to a challenge on the filibuster?
Well, the House has to send the bill over first, and the way they're doing it is they're taking this NASA bill. They're basically going to gut the bill and throw in their so-called voting rights bill, which we all know is a federalization of the election process, send it over to the Senate to avoid a filibuster, the initial filibuster, saying we're going to move to proceed to the bill. It's a way, it's a procedural way to get around one filibuster. So they get the bill to the Senate, and then it's game on, and then they have a debate. And at the end of the process, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer will file cloture. He'll wait 2 days. He'll have a vote. It'll be a 60 votes to shut down debate. Then he'll stand up and say, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President of the Senate, or Madam President of the Senate, if Kamala Harris is there, I object. I don't think it's constitutional to filibuster this bill. And they'll have a vote. And if they have 50 votes plus Kamala Harris, they'll basically just ignore the rules of the Senate and establish a precedent in the Senate that you can't filibuster this one bill. It's basically the beginning of the end of the filibuster.
Well, we already know that Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and possibly John Tester and others don't support changing the filibuster rules, or at least that's what they've stated publicly. So what is Schumer banking on happening here that he would be willing to even bring this up for a vote?
100% bullying tactics, trying to bully. And we've seen it. We've seen Manchin and Sinema being out in public and getting bullied and yelled at by activists to try and force them to vote for this. So I think it's a little bit of brinksmanship on the part of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to try and bully members into voting for this change. And if not, I think they're trying to preserve a political issue for their base.
Now, the Senate does have interesting rules, to say the least, Brian. That's why you're here, because you've had to maneuver these things. Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, he's threatened now that if Democrats try this, he's going to force votes on a bunch of Republican-sponsored bills and pieces of legislation. That explain that to me. Why doesn't he do that anyway? Or is it just sort of out of a bare modicum of respect that you don't bog things down that you know aren't going to go anywhere? And so, therefore, he hasn't pushed bills, but now he will?
Well, it's called the nuclear option for a reason. Basically, what happens is when one side does it, the other side says, oh, great, we have no rules anymore. So you can really go over the top and completely ignore the Senate rules and just start saying you're going to do things that specifically violate the rules, like offering motions to proceed to bills and offering amendments when you're not allowed to, for the sole purposes of appealing the ruling of the chair and getting a number of votes. So
I see.
It is possible for him to play hardball, but it's it'll set the Senate back even further than they are right now.
I thought that Senator Tom Cotton had a really effective speech yesterday where he basically just used Senator Chuck Schumer's words in the past defending the filibuster and repeating those for everyone to hear. So
yeah, he did a Joe Biden. He plagiarized right. Schumer right there.
How is Schumer going to explain this flip-flop that he's doing here?
Well, like many politicians, he's going to ignore the fact that he had that position in the past.
Right.
You look back to former Senate Majority Leader Bobby Byrd, he gave a big speech at the Center for American Progress back in 2005 opposing the nuclear option on nominations, and yet Chuck Schumer is trying to invoke the name of Bobby Byrd to bully Joe Manchin into voting for this rules change. It's really absurd. I mean, most every Democrat was a violent supporter of the filibuster back in the day, but now they've completely abandoned that position.
Not just supporter of the filibuster, but they used it. They used it often. They used it as recently as when Trump was president, hundreds and hundreds of times here. So, I mean, Brian, obviously there's hypocrisy here, but if you zoom out, it seems to me that, and correct me, please, that's why you're here. Every time there has been a whittling away of the filibuster rules, whether it's for the federal bench or for the Supreme Court, it seems that it was Harry Reid or the Democrats who went ahead and did it, and they may have gotten some brief satisfaction, but ultimately Republicans ended up exploiting that change in the long run for their benefit. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, this is the beginning of the end. You're absolutely right. When Harry Reid did it back in 2013, he basically got up on the Senate floor and said that filibusters are unconstitutional for all nominations with the exception of the Supreme Court, which doesn't make any sense. And so Republicans exploited that, changed it, and now we're seeing the same thing. Democrats are going to get up and say, oh, it's unconstitutional filibuster this one bill. Well, that's not going to stand. It is going to set the precedent that you can just toss aside the filibuster when you want to.
And going to the substance of the bill, I mean, I find it rather ironic that they're talking about how they need to institutionalize, you know, these federal election laws to secure democracy. This is all about democracy. But it seems like the way that they're getting there is fundamentally anti-democratic.
It's 100% anti-democratic because you're ignoring the will of the voters in each state. You know, Each state wants to control their own redistricting. Each state wants to control how long the voting process happens in their state and whether what procedures they're going to use to have mail-in voting. I mean, that's all should be up to state voters and state elected officials, but they're federalizing all that, making a one-size-fits-all solution for every American, which is unconstitutional because it ignores federalism and it's just flat out wrong.
Hey, Brian Darling, do you have time for one more segment? Because I think our audience kind of geeks out on this stuff. It's definitely, you know, the kind of discussion that fascinates people. And there's a reason why the Senate is different from the House. And I'd love for you to speak on that in a minute if you can. Can you stay with us one more?
Of course.
Cool. We'll stick with Brian Darling here in a moment. Because this is about changing the very nature of the Senate. There's a reason why our founders envisioned the Senate to be different than the House. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. We continue here with Brian Darling, who worked on the Senate for years with Senator Rand Paul. And Brian, I just want to reflect here a little bit, because a lot of people hearing this, you know, the arguments from AOC and from Biden, I mean, it's amazing to hear the arguments from Biden now after 40 plus years in the Senate. He understands this. He knows better. He's just it's just so manipulative and so disingenuous. But they make these soundbite arguments that go well on, you know, late night comedy shows like Rachel Maddow, where they say, you know, well, this is undemocratic. You know, since when should a minority of people be able to override the majority of the members of this body and all that stuff? And they take for granted people's ignorance and the fact that people are uneducated in this country as to why we have two different chambers. Can you take a moment, please, just in case people don't have these weapons in their arsenal to fight back against the idiot in the cubicle next to them, why the Senate is structured the way that it is, why it has been vital to the stability of our nation that the Senate is structured in the way that it is?
Yeah, we live in a republic, a democratic republic, that has a Senate that originally our founders set up to represent the interests of each state. And each state, basically back in the day, you had state legislatures that would appoint two senators to represent the interests of the state in the Senate, and the House was elected by the people. And that was the way it developed over the years. The Constitution was changed. Now we have direct election of senators, but there's still, the Senate is still supposed to represent the interests of each state. And that's why it's different. And over the years, the House and the Senate has developed very differently with the rules. And in the House, you have a new rule basically for every bill, whereas in the Senate, you have rules that go on and on and on, because the Senate, unlike the House, is a continuing body. The House, every 2 years, changes. Every 2 years, they have an election, and every 2 years, all members are sworn in, whereas in the Senate, only one-third of each of the members are sworn in every term, because you have one-third of, you know, you have the senators serving six-year terms and the House serving two-year terms. So the institutions have developed differently over the years because that's what our founders wanted.
I found that Biden's speech was a good reminder of why the Senate is so important as well. When a president tries to bully Americans and say that millions of them are racist because they don't support his agenda and that senators are blocking what he wants to do, I mean, that's why it exists in the first place. So what was your reaction to Biden's speech, Brian?
Yeah, Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell pointed out that that was not the Joe Biden he knew when Joe Biden was a senator and served in the Senate. You know, it seems like Democrats really enjoy and using, basically calling Republicans racist and using that term constantly to say, if you oppose what we want, you're a bad person. And it's a way to dehumanize Republicans, to basically call them that and say, how dare they oppose this, what we're doing? We're going to toss aside the rules in the Senate to pass this one bill because this issue is so important and the opponents are just bad people for opposing it, when obviously, I mean, this is an issue that we're Republicans of a good faith opposition on the issue of federalism and the idea that the states make these decisions, not the federal government. And it's really over the top. It's leading to this real division in our country, and it's not politically helpful for the future of our nation.
Yeah, I'd love for you to comment on your former boss there, Rand Paul. You worked for him as his senior communications director and advisor. The ongoing showdown with Anthony Fauci, I think, is critical. It's a critical conversation our nation must have. I'm glad that a couple of other senators are finally jumping on board with Senator Paul to engage in Anthony Fauci over these things, showing that the emperor has no clothes. How does this end, though? I mean, you know Senator Paul pretty well. What's the end game with this showdown?
Well, the end game's starting to happen. I think the American people are being educated that there is a real debate, and the media needs to dig in on gain of function. And was it a creation of the government? Did government fund research that led to the coronavirus? And that's a debate that we need to have. That's a debate that scientists need to have. And when Fauci's dismissive of that debate, it's really shows that he's more of a politician than a spokesman for science. And I think that you can see his demeanor. You can see that during hearings, the way he refuses to answer questions, he'll just avoid the questions and attack the questioner. He even called a senator a moron yesterday, which is unbelievable that somebody would have the gall to go into a Senate hearing and insult the United States senator. Not right. And it shows that he deflects and he's just not answering questions now.
Yeah, although Mazie Hirono, I mean, we could make an exception there if somebody called her a moron, couldn't we, Brian? I mean... Leave it there.
No comment.
Brian Darling, always good to talk to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, his organization is Liberty Government Affairs, and we appreciate him joining us today. And, Amber, we have an update out of Loudoun County. That rapist in the Loudoun County schools that got so much attention because of two sexual assaults at two different high schools was sentenced yesterday by the judge. That this sex offender, this young person, has been put on the sex offender registry for life, which is a remarkable move considering this person is 14 years old. But the judge was so disturbed by the psychological evaluation of this person that they felt compelled to do so. And again, just a reminder, the school superintendent and the school board covered up this person's behavior and move them to another school so that they could assault another. And now there's a report that there could be a third victim.
Yeah, during the trial, they found out that there might have been a third victim. And something very disturbing was said by the second victim in her statement, which was that they were not told what this student was accused of when he was moved to their high school.
Right. Yeah, this is it. This scandal. Listen, we're going to ask Jason Miaris, the incoming Virginia Attorney General, about this and about the behavior of the school board and about the behavior of the school district, and how really ask him if Loudoun is a one-off here or if this potentially could be a systemic problem throughout the Commonwealth. That's coming up. And also, in a moment, we'll turn our focus to the Fairfax County schools, where many children are conducting classes, it appears.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL Fan Festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.